Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Andrew Millen, and you're listening to the Celtic Soul podcast, and you're all very welcome back, folks. Today on the show, I'll be chatting to former Celtic goalkeeper Jonathan Gould. Gouldie will be always remembered as the unsung hero who came from third-choice goalkeeper at Bradford to Celtic's first-choice stopper during that famous 1997-98 season, when Celtic stopped Rangers doing 10 in a row, and during that league campaign, he only conceded 24 goals, and what a season it was, a rollercoaster season under Wimmy Anderson. He also won a treble with Martin O'Neill and a League Cup under Kane Dalglish and Tommy Burns to add to the one he won with Wimmy Anderson. He served under five different managers at Celtic, including John Barnes, and was goalkeeper during that infamous night against Inverness Caledonian Thistle. And he also knows a thing or two about a new manager, Andrew Postecoglou, who he came up against during his time coaching in Australia, and he tells me he always came off second best. So folks, thanks for the continued support, and as you know by now, we do produce free content across all our platforms, we do not have a Patreon, and we do not put content behind a paywall. What we do ask, if you're enjoying the podcast and you can afford it, please hit the donate button on our homepage at CelticFans.com. For as little as the price of a pint, you can help us to continue to grow the podcast and our other independent Celtic media platforms as we enter our 20th season producing Celtic fan-driven media. We're also looking for episode sponsors for the podcast for the new season. And also, if you want, you can sponsor us in the fanzine. Advertisers have the benefit of advertising across all our platforms, in video, audio, fanzine, social media, and on the website. We are fully fan-funded and sponsored by Celtic-minded businesses who share our values. For more information, you can contact us through the website, on social media, or by emailing us at info@celticfanzine.com. If you visit our website, you can also support us by becoming a member, buying, subscribing, or as I said earlier, donating for the price of a pint. And you can also visit our online shop and check out our latest t-shirts, badges, and merchandise. I hope you've all been enjoying the good weather and the Euros, which has been the best tournament in years. I think you'll all agree. And I also got out and about around Ireland to hook up with some Celtic supporters clubs during our wee break and get their thoughts on last season, the new manager, and the upcoming season, which everyone seems to be looking forward to. And looking forward to even more to get back to Glasgow and into Celtic Park after renewing their season books. And one or two told me they did have a few sleepless nights to make the decision, would they go again after such a bad season last year? But I suppose the emotional attachment is always going to get us. And those who run the club seem to know that. But look, there is positive news about the return to football grounds in Scotland. Some are talking about as soon as August. That may be a bit premature, but look, when we can, we're going to be there and it's going to be great. But we have to be aware that the virus is still out there, spreading. But thankfully now, I'm fully vaccinated and most of my mates that I travel with are fully vaccinated. So hopefully we can get that digital passport, get back to Glasgow, get back into the pubs, back into the hotels, back spending money. And the most important thing, back following the boys for Celtic Park. And who knows, maybe an away day down the road this season. Stuff we took for granted for so many years. And we've also started work, folks, on issue 116 of the fanzine. And thank you to everyone who bought the print edition of issue 115 of More Than 90 Minutes, which is now, I'm glad to say, sold out. You can still download the digital edition at our online shop on CelticFanzine.com. And if you want to make sure you never miss a copy, you can subscribe for as little as $5.99. And all those subscribing for Televisions will receive a free t-shirt. You'll also get a digital copy in your inbox of every issue and access to all our digital back issue library. So what's been happening down Celtic way since we took our wee break? Well, the big news is Angie is in the hot seat, and the new CEO, Don McKay, has replaced Peter Lowell as the man charged with putting last season's mess behind us and moving forward. The new manager has a massive task ahead to rebuild a broken squad and stamp his style of play on the team, with the Champions League qualifier only weeks away. The on-loan players have returned to their parent clubs, and we've signed two young players from Sheffield Wednesday, who we will discuss on the next Talk from the Terrace, when Matt McGlone, editor of The Alternative View, will be joining me for a chat. I'm sure we'll also mention Lee Griffiths, who has signed a new one-year deal when many had predicted his days were numbered at the club as a Celtic player. And I see John Hartson tipping him on Twitter to get 25 goals this season. Let's hope Big John's correct and he can find the form that got us out of our seats in past seasons. I suppose a bit of a prodigal son returning, really, if he turns on the style this season. And great to see the Celtic embracing Celtic fan media eventually, because last season there was so much going on and so little coming out from the PR department and the media department. But look, we're delighted that we got the invite to the recent fan media press conference with the new manager and the new CEO, and Aaron Boyle attended for us. And if you want to check out Aaron asking questions to Dom and Angie, you can do so on the Celtic Soul Shots podcast. We will also have the full press conference up on the Celtic Fanzine TV, and actually that is up already, so visit Celtic Fanzine TV and you can check out both of them. And we'll also put that press conference out as a bonus podcast for those who prefer to listen audio while they're out strolling with the dog or maybe driving. So folks, please visit Celtic Fanzine TV on YouTube and hit the subscribe button, and you can check out a playlist where you will find all our shows: Talk from the Terrace, Celtic AM, Millish Meets, Celtic Soul Shots, Grandale History. And we also have some of the press conferences that we've attended via Zoom with Celtic FC, and the one I mentioned there earlier with Aaron. And also you can listen to all our Celtic Soul podcasts on the YouTube channel as well. We also have a new project on the way after moving into our new studio this week, and a big shout out to Ronan for getting the studio soundproofed and setting up the new equipment, which should improve the quality of the sound even more, he tells me. And don't forget, all Celtic Soul podcasts are available on all platforms, and please follow or subscribe on your preferred platform provider. All podcasts, both audio and video, are also available on our CelticFanzine.com website, and you can also subscribe to our newsletters by visiting the website. And don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook and Twitter. So without further ado, here's how we got on when I chatted to Jonathan Gould. Jonathan Gould is a former Celtic goalkeeper signed by Wim Jansen from Bradford. He would go on to win the League Cup or win the league when Celtic stopped Rangers doing 10 in a row. He only conceded 24 goals in that league campaign and has been labelled the unsung hero of Wim's successful season in charge. He played under five different managers during his time at Celtic, where he went on to win the League Cup under Kane Dalglish before winning a treble in Martin O'Neill's first season in charge. Hi, Jonathan. You're very welcome to the Celtic Soul podcast. You're now on the other side of the globe, where you are the goalkeeping development manager at New Zealand Football. How's things going over there? You seem to have come out of the COVID-19 after lockdown early. Is life back to complete normality? And how are you enjoying the current role?
Yeah, normality. So I'm not sure that's always the case at the moment in this world anyway, but as near to normal as we can be. I arrived back just over a year ago. I had to do my 2 weeks in quarantine, which was pretty tough, getting into a routine of seeing nobody and not even allowed to be getting out of the hotel room. But that's why I think they've been so successful at keeping COVID out. They locked the island down. And I would say in the last 11 months, we've led a pretty normal life over here.
Yeah, you're lucky. We're starting to get back to some kind of normality here. Well, the beer gardens are open, and I think I'm in Ireland and Glasgow's a little further ahead. So they're talking now about getting back into football stadium as early as August. So fingers crossed, but who knows? We don't know with this new variant. Now, anyway, Jonathan, we've a new Celtic manager, Andrzej Postecoglou. You've coached in Australia. Did you come across him? And what's your thoughts on him?
Yeah, I came across him on a number of occasions. Teams usually got beat by his. It was when I was at Perth Glory and also at the Wellington Phoenix. And Yeah, he's the teams that he put together in a very, very short space of time were hugely successful. He took out two A-League titles here. He went a season unbeaten, an invincible team, which, as we all know, is very, very difficult to do in any level of football. And more than anything, it was his style of play that really grabbed the nation. He's a purist, but he's not daft at the same time. He knows there's times when you can play, there's times when you absolutely need to play a different way. And he had that good mix. And the success he had, as I said, was remarkable over here.
Yeah, were you surprised when Celtic came in from?
I think everybody was probably surprised. Obviously, you think of Eddie Howe had been in the wings. I don't know, he hadn't been anywhere, Eddie, for a couple of months, and everyone expected him to get the job. And I think there was an element of surprise, but I don't think we should be surprised given his CV. For an English speaking person to go over to Japan and win the league in the J League, you can't underestimate that achievement. And I think that shows the mettle of Ange. I know he's going to be an uncompromising figure for people to deal with. He's got his method, and he's going to implement that. And if he's given the time, he could very, very easily have the same kind of impact that Brendan Rodgers had with his style of football.
Oh, we hope so. That would make us very happy, Johnny.
That's it. And I think that's what people mustn't get away from. And I think Ange said it in the press over the last couple of days. Every single person that supports Celtic wants Ange to succeed. And that doesn't matter who you are, ex-player, the man at the door as you walk in to Parkhead, they all want you to succeed. And that's what he starts with.
Yeah, no, we are excited, but we're kind of a bit worried because he's so little time. We have a big Champions League coming, and we signed a young defender today. And Griffiths has signed an extension to his contract, so that's something. But I suppose we're a bit worried about who's going out the door, because with such a leaky defence last year, and you played in goals for Celtic. The goalkeepers this year didn't have the best seasons. In fact, the Greek lad that came in had a nightmare. But you were completely different when you came in. You'd probably the best season ever when you came to Celtic.
It was probably good timing. I had a very, very good back four. Like you said, though, I had, Reaper, Stubbs and Anoni in front of me. I had fullbacks. Stefan Mahe had probably one of his best seasons in his career as well. Jackie McNamara and Tom Boyd. When you think of those names, they were very secure. We had when Paul Lambert came in, he was that four in front of the back line, and Craig Burley in front. We were a very, very solid team. But it took even that it probably took us three or four games to get that going as a unit. Well, we had a couple of issues early doors, and Vim had to correct that. I think what people have got to realise as well, it's actually not Ange's fault that he's so late into this. So that's why I think we've got to give him that time. And you're right, the squad at this moment in time does need a little bit of an overhaul. It needs probably the spine of the team renewing, and hopefully he'll get the resource and the patience to do that.
Yeah, as I said, you come in now from Bradford. You were in the reserves, I believe, and then the pressure that season must have been immense, because to stop Rangers from doing 10 in a row, it was the same for, I suppose, the Rangers players this season.
Yeah, I think it probably helped a few of us, Andrew, that we didn't quite understand. If you think Vim and Jock and Murdo bought in quite a number of players in that. In that window before the season started, there was myself, Reggie, Stefan, and Henrique, of course, and there were probably a couple of others. And we didn't come into the pressure pot as it had been felt over that period of time, getting up to nine. So it was something that we learnt about, but we hadn't been brought up with, in the season prior to that. So I think that helped us. Having said that, I'm not going to hide away from the fact that over the next 9 months, it did become quite pressurized. And, you know, there were moments, there were periods during the season where, you know, the league seesawed. And it took some character from a group of lads that got on very well together to make sure that we pulled it off in the end.
And when did you become aware that Celtic were interested in you?
It was actually driven initially by an agent who rang me up on about 7 o'clock in the morning and said Celtic need a goalkeeper and are you interested? And I was actually third choice. You were doing me credit there, Andrew. I was third choice at Bradford. I couldn't get in the reserve team at the time. And because I'd played for Scotland and worked under Murdo McLeod, when my name went in there, I think there was some thought given to it. But I learned after the event that my agent actually didn't put me forward. He put Brian Gunn forward. And so it was only the fact that I asked my dad straight after the phone call I had. I said, do you know anybody at Celtic? And he knew Jock. So that phone call went into Jock Brown, and really over the space of 7 or 8 hours, we negotiated a contract. I drove from Bradford to Celtic, met Vim and the crew, and the rest was sort of my history and part of the club's history now. So it's pretty awesome.
And did you know much about what you were coming into? Because everyone knows Celtic's a big club, but it is a goldfish bowl, Glasgow.
Yeah, I did, and ironically, when I first came out to New Zealand in 1989 as a young player, we were on a scheme where Wimbledon used to lend two players every year to a club called Napier City Rovers. And my father was the manager at Wimbledon. And he sent me over with a lad called Brian McAllister, who was a real strong left-footed centre-back, left-back, and who actually went on to play for Scotland as well. And he was a massive Celtic supporter. So I used to room with Brian, and every Sunday morning our time, I used to have to listen to all the Celtic games on the radio. So I was, and he used to sleep under his Irish flag. He was that mad, right? And that was my introduction. And we also had a couple of players in the team over here in New Zealand that were huge Rangers supporters. So I got to understand it pretty quickly at that age. I never dreamt I'd end up playing for the club. But I did know about the rivalry even 14,000 miles away.
Oh, and that was the League Cup, I suppose, took some of the pressure off because there was silverware for Wim. Because, as you said, the start wasn't ideal. He didn't really have a pre-season and lost a couple of games. But it was a roller coaster season as a fan, and I can imagine what it was like as a player. But then, you know, it comes to that day. In the sun, Celtic Park, full house, massive pressure. But you got the job done, and there must have been some celebrating done by you, because we done some celebrating that night and the next day.
We were disappointed we didn't take it out at Dunfermline, to be honest, because that would have given us extra week of celebrating, you know. So I don't know quite how we'd have ended up after that week. As it was, you know, you win it at Parkhead in front of your faithful supporters. And one of the videos that I watch every now and then, and you see it every year, it seems to come around on Twitter, was the video that was done really from a crowd's perspective. And you can see the fingernails being bitten. You can see everyone with, you know, folded arms, really uptight, and that didn't dissipate until that goal of Harold's went in. Once that went in, you could feel the tension drain out of the stadium, and then it became euphoric.
Yeah, and it's kind of fairy tale stuff. Like for yourself, within a season, you've gone from, as you say, third choice at Bradford to becoming a hero, and as I said earlier, the unsung hero, because you only conceded 24 goals in that season, which I think was a record in the 90s for Celtic.
Yeah. I mean, I take a little bit of stick because, you know, people say, the goalkeeper that stopped 10, and the lads always end up reminding me, wherever they are in the world, that it was, so it was just you that stopped 10. And it's not like that at all. I think when you look back at that group and how cohesive we became after those first two or three games that we had issues with. The mix of characters, the mix of ability, we had some, obviously had some quite brilliant players in that team, and we had, you know, arguably Celtic's best ever number seven, and that's putting alongside, Jinky, for goodness sake. Henrik Larsson was a phenomenon for us, not just as a player, because obviously we relied on his goals, but his work rate, his inner belief kind of transferred into us as well. He's pretty stoic as a person, and it took a while to get to know him, but we loved him as a group of footballers.
Yeah, just on Henrik, because did you realise just how good he was when he started out at Celtic? Was it evident from the start that he was a bit special, yeah, or did it grow on you?
You can tell within the first 5 minutes of a training session, usually, how good a player is. And a lot of that, from Henrik's perspective, was his movement. You can have the skill, you can have the ability to finish in front of goal as he did, but it's his movement that got him into those positions. And he knew how to pull a defender out, make that dart across. He kind of had this telepathic ability to know that when someone got into a wide area, where he needed to go in respect to where that cross was being delivered from. Whether they got to the byline and he would just hold off for the cutback, whether it was a further out cross and he would probably hang out and then he'd rise at the back. You know, you can see him now when he'd get up at the far stick and hit the ball, or whether he needs to get across the front post. And there was also, there was a good feeling between him and Simon Donnelly at times as well. Simon would make good runs, but also he'd see that run from Henrik inside the defender and used to play him in a lot. He was a joy to watch. And I was no one should have been surprised when he went to Barcelona and probably turned round a European Cup final in the last 15 minutes. And that was because of his movement that he moved other defenders out of position for his teammates to create space.
Yeah, I think when you look back at, the Barcelona players, they really taught so much of him, and that was a magnificent team. And you're right, he did. He came off against Arsenal, and we've spoken about it before in the podcast, and he was involved in the two goals. And I suppose if anyone deserved a European winners' medal, it was Henrik after the disappointment of Seville, where he scores twice and still loses. And we, although we had a brilliant run and a brilliant week, but we were heartbroken that day. Now, another player that is kind of a bit genius came in the following season was Lubo, which was probably the highlight, along with me, Albie, coming in with Dr. Joe. Were you surprised when Wim left so quickly?
Yeah, we were devastated, and it's probably been documented about how it happened, and we tried to stop it as a group of players. I remember us being in Estoril, but we'd been taken away to play, I think it was Sporting Lisbon, in an end of season game, which you don't want to play in those anyway when you've finished a season, let alone at the end of a season where you've just won the league. You just want to really relax, and that was his last two or three days with us as a manager, and as a group of players. We got together. I remember standing in a lift and saying, right, we need to do something about this. And we spoke to sent a letter through to Jock Brown expressing our displeasure that the fact that Wim wasn't being encouraged to stay. But I think the measure of Wim was, although he didn't really want to leave, but he knew, or he gave the impression that there was a principle around it, and we respected that as a group of players. We didn't like it, but we'd come to really admire him as a man over that 12 months. And I think the biggest thing was that he trusted us and obviously worked under quite a few managers as a player and as a coach. But I remember him only really saying stuff to me on one occasion about keeping the back four further up the field. And so for the rest of the season, he just let me get on with my job. And when someone allows you to do that, that's a massive vote of faith in you anyway, especially as a goalkeeper.
Yeah, and confidence.
Yeah.
Like, and obviously, yous are good that Wim's gone, but the doctor comes in. And I suppose the highlight of that season was a game that you missed, which was the 5-1, when Tony Warner came up on loan. Were you injured then?
Yeah, I was injured. I think I'm not sure which one it was. It was either when I got injured playing against FC Zurich in Europe. I think I did my knee and Tony came in. But I remember being in the stand and knowing what it was like to thump Rangers from a supporter's perspective on that day. And you're right, it was probably the birth of Lubo Mravchik. And again, you know, an amazing talent. And even though he was a little bit older, he still had the ability to turn the game on a sixpence and did it on a number of occasions for us.
Yeah, he was a magnificent player, magnificent to watch. And he had great longevity as well, because when you think he played right through to O'Neill, and I know he used them, he used them sparingly at times, but magnificent to watch. And another player that came in then was Mialbi. Now, you spoke there about the back four that was there when you came in. Now, obviously, Martin played a back three. If you could pick a back three or a back four out of all those players under all those managers, is it a hard job or does a couple of players just stick out that you would pick to have in front of you any day in a big game?
Yeah, for kind of different reasons as well. I loved the fact that Mark Reaper was 6'4" and could head a ball. Because
do him this season, the last season.
you know, because when that ball's coming in your box, you want someone that's fairly dominant. I remember having Colin Hendry a couple of times when I played for Scotland, and you love having him in a certain position. I loved the fact that I had someone like Stubbsy encouraging me to actually roll the ball out, and so we could start play from the back. And you knew he had the technical ability. And like you say, Dolph Lundgren or Johan Mialbi, however you want to call him, he was just a proper rugged defender. I quite liked Johan when he played in front of the back four, because I thought he gave that defensive understanding and a little bit of added security. You know, it'd be remiss of me to say, because Tommy Boyd played centre half quite a lot for us when I was there. You know, and Rico Anoni in that year was excellent. And I remember big Malky Mackay coming in on several occasions and doing a fabulous job. If you think of that, you know, there wasn't a dearth of centre backs. And then we had Jos Vaal-Harren, even Ram under Martin O'Neill. But so it is really difficult for me to pick a back four out of that. And I would go back four because I like two centre forwards.
you named plenty of really decent, high end defenders that we've had, because you know there's always a few slip through the net, and one that slipped through the net was under the next management team, which was the dream team of John Barnes and Kenny Dalglish, and one defender was Raphael Shuey. And Oliver Tebbeley, so that was your two centre halves. So you must have been on shaky ground in that net.
Did I miss them out? Did I? Sorry, I forgot them. No, I just think they came in at those two in particular. Raphael, goodness me! I mean, the rumours were that he'd never been watched. He'd only been sort of video scouted, and you know, having been on the coaching side of things now for the last 15 years, there's no way you can sign a football player just by watching him on the TV screen. There's so much more to the game and to somebody's ability to do a job. And that was apparently how he was signed. And he, you know, for the kind of carry, you know, he was a nice lad, Raphael. I remember him, us going away, on a trip, during halfway through the season. We went to Portugal, I think, and he is a good lad. I think Olivier, you know, he was a little bit all over the place, Olivier. He had some real ability, had pace, but I don't think there was a gel between him and anybody else in the back. And you know who we've missed big Bobo Baldi. Now come on, there's not many better big centre backs than Bobo, and I never used to argue with him. I used to, if he ever had a go at me, I'd just say, yeah, you're right, Bobo.
Yeah, I believe Tomo hidden the locker. When he went for Chris Sutton, I believe. Is that true?
Yeah, I believe so. He's Bobo, my goodness, yeah. Man Mountain.
Yeah, it's funny all the defenders you've named there, like the good, the bad, and sometimes ugly. but just take us back to the doctor leaving and John Barnes coming in, because when I've spoke to players that played in that team, they're not very complimentary. And around this time last year, John done some Celtic podcasts, and it sounded like he was trying to rewrite history in saying that he was kind of left out and bits and pieces like that. So, you know, from your perspective, what was it like when he came in?
With John? I think that one of the things that I can remember vividly is Tommy Burns, you know, our hero and amazing football man and Celtic man. He started pre-season because John hadn't quite arrived. And I remember us being down at Strathclyde Park and Tommy was putting us through our paces, and it was really tough. And it was John's first morning or afternoon, and at the end of the running and all the body circuits we did up on the top of the hill in Strathclyde, we came together as a group, and John said to us, you know, respect everything that you guys have done at this football club, and you'll all be getting your opportunity to show me. And I think the next day he'd signed something like four or five players. You know, I know he'd signed Dimitri. So he kind of immediately didn't have that trust in what he was telling you. And I think what kind of let John down was, we had Terry McDermott was there, and he obviously had Kenny in the background, but I think, I just think, and again, this is showing John respect, because he was a most marvellous football player, and I played, I'd actually made my Premier League debut against John Barnes when he was at Liverpool, and I was playing for Coventry, and, you know, I remember back, he put a couple of crosses in my hand early doors, which gave me a bit of a confidence boost. But so I need to respect John Barnes here, but I think the whole gig was way too early for him. And as much as he thought he had people around him that would help, and I'm not talking about Kenny, and I'm not talking about Terry here, but I think he probably could have done with another mentor. I remember that Ray Harford was mentioned in dispatches. I know Kenny was keen to bring Ray in, but you know, John needed a lot more help, and I'm not sure he was prepared to take as much counsel as he should have done at the time. And the dressing room, he lost it very, very quickly.
And never regained it. And when you talk about the dressing room, obviously, like he had a very bad luck with Henrik getting injured and being ruled out for all the season. He came back, I think, the last game of the season. But then, you know, the ICT game, which, you know, keeps you know, we talk about the good times, but, you know, sometimes we have to talk about the bad times as well, which was a bit of a disaster, to say the least. He lost his job the next day, and you played in that game.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had the stories about Viduka and, you know, the whole dressing room gone. Do you remember much about the build-up to that game, half-time and even after the game?
Well, you know, the build-up to the game was that the game was cancelled from the previous Saturday or 10 days before. And just because there was a speaker wobbling because the winds were higher. And you just wonder if history had been different, whether we'd have gone out on the Saturday and won the game. You just don't know. I the whole thing had been coming. But it still wasn't that the players were prepared to let that happen. It was one of those games that, you know, even at half time, we were still well in that game. And I've seen the chances. I've watched some of the highlights back to that game in the last 12 months, because obviously the anniversary came up. And when you look back, we should have got ourselves back in it. Absolutely. But not to have Viduka on the park for 45 minutes obviously had an impact on our ability to do that. I was talking about Mark to someone the other day. Obviously he's an Australian lad, and he could be very, very different at times, but he wanted him on the field. And so I think that's where I come down to the lack of experience, where I know that he was challenged, his effort was challenged by Eric Black, who was the number two at the time. And that's not always your number two's role. That's got to come from your manager. And I was the last person into the dressing room as a goalkeeper. You're always the last in because you go and get your drinks bottle and you're furthest away from the tunnel. And it was absolutely bedlam when I came in. and it didn't get any better. And that was because the manager, John, at the time, wasn't capable of bringing that group together and really focusing on the fact that we had to go out and be very, very professional for 45 minutes. Not just to save his job, but to win a game that we absolutely should be winning.
Yeah, it was a huge disappointment. But there was a small bit of light at the end of the tunnel for us as fans, because we got, I remember boarding the bus very early in the morning from my hometown, and we headed for Hampden. And we got over the line in Hampden. It wasn't the greatest final I was ever at, but no, it gave us something to celebrate and like something to enjoy. And like, Tommy was back with Doug Leash then, and like two Celtic legends. And as we were stuck in Stranraer that night, I think we missed the boat. We ended up getting a lock in the little pub till about 4 in the morning, which helped. But you know, like, what are your thoughts on Tommy and Doug Leash? Because they're two Celtic legends, like, and they've probably had two different paths, because Tommy has done everything at the club, whereas Kenny is remembered for his time as a player.
Well, Tommy knew what a dressing room and how important that dressing room was, and you know, his demeanour, the way he treated people, and the respect that they had for him in return as a Celtic legend. And then Kenny, I think they already knew what the problems were, and therefore they were able to fix them straight away. I was probably one of the first casualties, because I'd fallen out with Ile Berkovic at the time, and it was pretty public. And Kenny left me out, and he came back. But when I went to see him, I said, look, I understand why he let me. I'm disappointed. I said, but I'm going to get back in the team. And he says, you know, you'll get another chance. He says, just think that now's the right time. And he was probably absolutely, you know, he was spot on. And I remember then getting back in the team, and obviously that led to the final. And you just knew his experience was capable of turning it around pretty quickly. And it would have been interesting actually to see if Kenny and Tommy could have gone on from that point and made a good fist of it. I think they probably would have done. They were a good duo in there, because Kenny could frown a bit and Tommy could bark a bit, but you knew it was coming from a really good place.
Yeah, I've heard about Tommy losing the plot in Ibrox, and because Tommy wore his hat and sleeve when it came to, you know, he always said he was the boy that got lucky, and he really like, every time we do an interview or a podcast, or you know, people write for the fanzine, or if it's something for YouTube, or just Tommy's name just comes up so much, you know, from the young and the old.
Yeah. The thing is, Andrew, you only get lucky if you work hard and you're committed to something. And we all know that Tommy Burns was so committed to that football club, and born out of that was what he perceived as lucky. What can I say? People have said enough about, or not enough. They say so much about Tommy Burns, and you know, I follow his boy on Twitter now, Jonathan, and I think he's kind of held a torch for his dad as well, and he doesn't need to, but obviously he's getting some solace out of that. But I think all the Burns family should be very proud of Tommy and everything and his legacy, really.
Yeah, and he hung around when Martin O'Neill came in, and when Martin came in, things just seemed to change, because when we beat, the players that came in, you know, Sutton, Tom would come in a little later, Hart's come in a year later, you know, they were all, you said Bobo, Useful Heron, they were all big, strong boys, the thing among us anyway was that we've been bullied by Rangers, and I think Martin saw that straight away, and he needed to bring in some physicality. But like, that was like, not only did he bring in that, but like, when you went to the wing backs, like, Bobby Petter was born again. And when you think back to the 6-2 game, that was Bobby's, Bobby's greatest ever game. He was man of the match, and everything seemed to just kick on from there. And obviously, you know, you have a fair Henrik up front and Sutton playing off him. It was magnificent time, but you were there, and like then another part of the fairy tale of treble.
Yeah. Yeah, who'd have thought that? No, Martin knew, we knew he was the boss the minute he walked in the door, Andrew, and again, you get that feeling of experience, and they say that a manager's sort of most important moment at club is that first 2 or 3 minutes when he meets the team. And that was certainly the case with Martin. He made it pretty clear that he was the boss, but also that he had an empathy towards us, a respect. You know, you're talking about a guy that had won, I think, 2 European Cups himself. So we had him on a pedestal as a football player. He'd worked under, you know, one of the most enigmatic managers in the history of British football, in Brian Clough. So he'd done his apprenticeship as a player and as a coach. And, you know, it was obviously a dream of his to come to a football club like Celtic. I dare say he probably wished he'd have stayed even longer. But, and again, that was one of the main things that I remember from Martin, was that first meeting with the supporters on the steps at Celtic Park. And, you know, that always stays with me as a player, when he said he would do everything in his power to bring success to this football club. And you knew he meant it, and you knew he was capable of doing that. So it was no surprise when he brought characters into our dressing room that wouldn't get bullied. And that was one of the first things we'd said in his presence, was that we felt as if we weren't going away from home and winning enough games 1-0. Obviously, we wanted to score more than that, but 1-0 was kind of a perceived great result away from home in any league. And we knew we had to do that more often if we wanted to turn the tide and make sure we won the league. To win the treble in that short space of time was remarkable. But it shouldn't really have been surprising given the nature of Martin as a football manager.
Yeah, a winner, as you said, you know, European Cup winner twice, and under Brian Clough, and I'm sure your dad crossed wires with Brian Clough a number of times. But, you know, we put Martin up on a pedestal, but he's also the man that released you.
Well, but I didn't see it that way. I mean, you know, I suppose initially I was really disappointed, but I just, when he first came in, there were a couple of teams that had expressed an interest. I wasn't sure whether I was going to start the season, and I think that was probably the what he was all about as a manager. He wanted to challenge us not just as players, but as people, and he kind of laid that challenge down to me. And I think I played the first 12 or 13 games of the season, and we were unbeaten. So I was quite unlucky to get left out at that point. It had probably come down to a couple of little scratchy performances. One in Europe, I remember, away in Finland, even though we won again. And I think when we got beat by Bordeaux, I think, again, I didn't see myself at fault for any of the goals, but Martin just felt as if he needed a little bit more physical presence, and went for Rab at 6'4". And he did release me, but I don't think I would ever change that 3 years, even though some of my ability to play was sporadic, or him giving me that opportunity, because I actually think you're better off being part of a successful squad than playing in a pretty average one. And I was part of a really successful squad over 3 years, 4 years now.
So, you know, the treble season or the stopping the 10 season, if you could choose one.
Yeah. I'd have to go back to stopping 10, really, from a personal perspective, from a whole club perspective. Treble is quite special. And I think the fact that turned everything around for the football club when you look back. And the players, I mean, the players that Martin brought in, and that, you know, you know, even as a player yourself, when players like Sutton, Hearts and Lenny walk in your dressing room, it gives you a lift. You think, oh, hey, we have got a team here. And it almost gives the coach less to do. He knows he's got people that are capable of transferring everything onto a football field on a regular basis.
Yeah, now you went in that January. Did you manage to make it to Seville?
No, I didn't. It was really weird that because we were in our winter break and I'd taken my wife and children to out to Spain just for a week's break. And I remember a phone call coming through from, I was playing golf with my son, who wouldn't have been very old at the time. And it was Martin and Martin was in Barbados, I think. He'd gone away for a week.
Look at him.
And he just said, look, he said, I had a club come in for you, Preston North End. You know, if you're out of contract at the end of the year, it's your decision if you want to go. And there was a financial aspect to it because I'd had a loyalty clause in my contract, put in by Martin, and he kind of took the financial aspect of it out. He made it a playing decision for me, and I just thought I need to go and play for the next two or three years of my career, and that's what I did. But I was talking to someone the other day, a player who was thinking of leaving a football club, and I said, your football club is capable of going on a massive journey. Think twice about doing that. And I suppose in retrospect, leaving, you know, when we were probably three games away from a European final wasn't the smartest idea, but it was, yeah, there was bigger picture stuff. And it was a shame because I'd love to be involved, in that journey with the boys. But, you know, as it was for the guys, it didn't turn out for them.
Yeah, it was a heartbreaking night, a magnificent run, and we won nothing that season. But I suppose we won the hearts of the people of Seville because we had such a wonderful time. You know, they opened the doors to us, they opened the fridges, and we drank all the beer. Now, listen, you grew up in a massive football family. Your dad, Bobby Gould, won the FA Cup with West Ham, and then he also won the FA Cup as a manager with the crazy gang Wimbledon, and went on to manage Wales. So was the pressure to play football, or did, you know, like, how do you grow up with like a famous footballing dad?
Well, you have a great time, to be perfectly honest. You know, when you're the son of a footballer, you get a big garden. I had two goals at the end of each garden. That's where your football journey starts. I used to go to all his games, even as a youngster, and dad had 13 or 14 clubs in his career. So every couple of years, I used to have to change jersey, whether it was Wolves, West Brom. I was a little bit too young for the Arsenal one. obviously West Ham. I've got a picture out in my barn out here that of me sitting there with the FA Cup in 1975 as a young kid in a goalkeeping strip, funny enough. Dad never really wanted me to be a footballer. He thought that there were elements of it, as much as he's obviously been in the game for his whole life, elements that he thought lacked security. But I probably made my mind up by the age of 19 or 20, that was all I wanted to do. And obviously took that pathway slightly differently because I went through the non-league route and came through the game that way. But there's certain things that are innate, and I think sometimes character's one of those, and that's why I think when things got poor for me or challenging for me as a footballer, it was the fact that I was the son of a footballer and the son of someone that had character himself that helped me pull through and achieve success in my football career.
And we had the final at the Crazy Gang.
Yeah, it was incredible. Well, we'd gone to, he'd left Coventry not long before that. And I was at Wembley the year before when Coventry beat Tottenham. I was a massive Coventry supporter because we were brought up in Coventry. My dad was a Coventry boy. So then to go there the next year, I lived in a flat with dad that backed onto Plough Lane, as it was then. And I saw firsthand for 6-7 months this crazy gang just go on an absolute journey. You talk about tight groups and people within dressing rooms that would not give an inch. And I was lucky enough to be in those dressing rooms and see it. It was incredible. And you think they went into that final and they were 7-1 against the team, Liverpool again. I'm pretty sure Barnsley was involved in that game.
I was just thinking that.
A team that, we're about to take the double out. And Wimbledon on the day were immense. 1-0. Keeper saves a penalty and you score from a set piece, which is your trademark. It was almost a perfect day for a Wimbledon supporter, maybe not a Liverpool one.
Unbelievable. And you were born in England, your dad manages Wales, and you play for Scotland through your grandparents who are from Lanarkshire.
My granddad, goodness me, played for Blantyre Vicks. He was a pro footballer at the time. My great granddad, I beg your pardon. Yeah.
And you played twice for Scotland, if my research is correct.
Yeah.
But you also got to go to a World Cup.
That was a bit of luck. That was good old Andy Gorham decided that he was going to go AWOL before the 1998 World Cup. I'd been over in Jersey for 3 days and celebrating with all the Jersey supporters because we'd obviously stopped at 10 and needless to say, I'd spent 3 days, not much sleep, plenty of alcohol, and then got a phone call to tell me that I needed to be on a plane to go to Washington to meet up with a World Cup squad. So I think I had a couple of days drying out and then managed to get myself back in the zone of being involved with Scotland in a World Cup, which was an amazing way to end the year.
But there is a touch of the fairy tale about your journey, because you're starting off non-league, you go to Celtic, you win so much as Celtic, especially like two really momentous seasons in that. Yeah. You go to a World Cup after you go on the piss with the lads. I'd like to see that film.
I don't know. Not sure I'd be allowed to see all of that film, but there you go. But it's been great fun. I think Tommy mentions the word lucky. We are fortunate to be involved in a game that in a world is sort of revered all over the world, and wherever you go, the Celtic supporters. It was an anniversary. I think it was 37 years for the New Zealand Celtic Supporters Club about a month ago, and I spoke to them on a Zoom link. And that's when you realise you won't go anywhere without finding a Celtic supporter somewhere.
Yeah, I ran a festival in Thailand, the Celtic Supporters Festival, and we had all the Asian clubs, with New Zealand, with all the Aussie clubs, and it was just at the start of COVID. So everybody arrived, and within about 5 days, New Zealand went first, then Australia, then the Hong Kong, and the last to go was the Europeans. I think the boys that were based in London and in the Midlands, they were last to go home. We were even gone before them. So you'll meet Celtic fans everywhere, and especially if you played in iconic teams and iconic seasons, you'll always get a drink bar for you, I think, Johnny. Now, Johnny, while we're reminiscing, I always get all my guests before they leave, jump into the Celtic Soul time machine and go back to a moment or a match in their life. And it doesn't have to be necessarily Celtic, but if there's a moment or a match that you could go back to, Johnny, where does that time machine take you to?
Okay, I'm going to go back to the St Johnstone game, and I can remember being told that because obviously either ourselves or Rangers could have won it. I think Rangers were away at Dundee United on the day. We were told that a helicopter would be waiting with the championship trophy, and I can vividly see now Harold score and then a couple of moments later seeing this or hearing this helicopter in the stadium. And that was when I actually realized that we were going to take the title out, whether it was the helicopter that had the trophy in it, I'm not sure, but there was one up there. And I think I can then, I remember coming for a cross and taking it really quite easily. And I launched it into the bottom right hand corner and that final whistle. And there was kind of a silence before there was an actual roll. We knew we'd carried something out that it was a mission that had been given to us as Celtic players. And we'd sort of repaid our faith back to the supporters that followed us over the life of the football club.
Yeah, the 90s were quite barren, and with the exception of Tommy's team winning the cup in 95. So we thank you and we thank all the players for that brilliant day, yeah, and brilliant night. And as the sunshine turned to darkness, no doubt players were celebrating as much as we were. we might have had an earlier start.
Yeah, probably saw you at some time, Andrew, and can't remember a thing about it.
Possibly. Johnny, it's been an absolute pleasure. I've been trying to get you on for a while, and you join a long list of goalkeepers that we've had in the show who have always entertained us. So all I can say is thank you very much for sharing your Celtic soul with us and taking time, and I'm sure all the viewers and listeners will love it. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been a privilege. Thank you, Andrew.
Brilliant, Johnny.
What a story. From non-league to the highs of Celtic Park, 6 medals, 5 managers, and even managed a trip to the World Cup, and it was also great to get his take on the new Celtic gaffer, Angie. So thanks very much, Johnny. Folks, as I said earlier, if you're enjoying our free content and you can't afford a small donation, please click the donate button by visiting CelticFanzine.com, where you'll see an icon there for a little advertising for the donate button. And that will allow us to continue to produce quality independent fan journalism across all our platforms, and hopefully soon back in the flesh at our pre-match show, Celtic AM. Thanks as always to our producer, Ron McQuillan, our video editor, Daniel Faulkner, Aaron Boyle for steering the good ship on the ground in Glasgow while we're away, to Richie, our graphic designer, thank you so much for your bits and pieces this week, and to all our fanzine and website contributors, and to all our guests who joined us this week for chat, and of course to you, the listeners, viewers and readers. Thank you for your continued support. The weekend is here, the Euros are down to the quarterfinals, and next Wednesday at 3 p.m. in Newport, Celtic will take on Sheffield Wednesday, which is available on your virtual season ticket via Celtic TV. Well, that's it for another Celtic Soul podcast, and this week we play out with my old neighbour, Cormac Judge, with a tune called Easter. Cormac has set the words of a poem by Hess Matthews to his music. So take it away, Cormac, and as always, folks, stay safe and keep the faith.
A lily weeps remorsefully, remembering our patriot dead. Dewdrops drip from a daffodil, recalling those that bled. Silent spirit raises the proclamation, after all these years. Ghost outside the GPO sings the voice of Padraig Pearce. Flag unfolds, giant green and gold, flying free like a bird. Harmoniously humming harps, heard echo every word. A long curlew cries above the skies, screeches o'er the hill. Young soldiers bravely battle, defeated at Boland's Mill. Common Amon, Conley, others convicted of a crime, trying tirelessly to save what's rightfully theirs and rightfully thine. In Kilmainham jail, tormented, treated severe as slaves, despairingly dead at dawn, worthy only of shallow praise. Thank you. Men of all ages, storm now rages, loved ones linger behind. Vigorously, valiantly in vain, during Easter, a time to remind. Lies for liberty, forever faithful, tired, tried tyranny to flee. Delicate doves hold so much love, nation's right to be free. Common among Conley, others convicted of a crime, are trying only for to save what's rightfully theirs and rightfully thine. In Kilmainham jail, tormented, treated severe as slaves, despairingly dead at dawn, were the only of shallow graves. Despairingly dead at dawn, were the only of shallow graves. Delicate doves, oh, so much love.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.